Hey everybody, James Tiley over here at CyberFM, and this is this week's edition of Digital Bytes with Johnny Fry's team Blockchain, and we have a great guest that we interviewed just offline a few minutes ago, and that will be the second segment here. But first, with Johnny, J-O-N-N-Y, Fry, when you find him on LinkedIn, you're going to want this newsletter. This week's pretty good, and we're going to go over it right now. I think Johnny's with us, right?
Yeah. Hi, James. Good to be back on air with you. And thanks for getting the Digital Bytes show sorted out on CyberFM.
It's definitely, we're growing, we're learning, kind of winging it.
Well, it's before we get going, I don't know whether you saw early this week, but you're familiar with PIMCO, the fixed interest fund manager.
Yes. Got
about $2 trillion under management. So they're a pretty big old outfit. And they've announced that they've been internally trading cryptocurrency for a little while. And they're going to basically start trading cryptocurrency as a firm, which is quite an announcement for a company as traditional and conservative as PIMCO to, you know, actually admit that it's getting involved in this sort of area.
Yeah, some of the other bigger firms they had opinions, right? They're like, yeah, no. No, we're not touching this. It's kind of interesting that PIMCO's like, yeah, by the way, we have been.
Yeah. But So it's just another example of how the institutions are realizing that actually there's some value to be had in this asset class. And I think on top of that, what's interesting is that as we see, in order to trade these assets, some of these crypto things, you've got to do your own fundamental analysis. You've got to try and understand where the value is and why would you buy one as opposed to t'other. And in doing that, you then have to get sucked in and try and have an understanding of the technology behind it. So you get involved in, you know, blockchain technology and smart contracts and all that sort of stuff. And then you start realizing that, okay, so you could either use it for, you know, a cryptocurrency, or you could use it to then potentially wrap or embed, you know, traditional assets. You know, it might be real estate or prop or equities or bonds or commodities or even, you know, just you know, pounds, dollars, yen, you know, Swiss francs, i.e. a stable coin. So it's the underlying technology which then can create the different classes of assets. And I think that's what's interesting. So I think you're going to see someone like PIMCO saying, okay, we're beginning to understand cryptocurrencies. Why can't we do this with fixed interest? Why can't we create structured debt instruments using blockchain technology and then lay on top of that smart contracts to actually help with, you know, things like sort of compliance and reporting and transparency and all that sort of thing. And that, I think that's where it starts to get really interesting from a sort of institutional and, you know, from your old days when you were on Wall Street, you know, compliance was always a big, big challenge.
Oh, I used to love my friends at the SEC. But, you know, you bring up an interesting, awkward situation. When you look at the more non-typical, I guess you call them meme coins right now, Doge and Shiba Inu and these viral currencies that are making their ways, I have the friends and family, the neighbors, you know, your Uber driver. It's like, hey, what are you investing in? What are you buying? And as much as I advocate and love what we're doing, I, because of where I come from Wall Street, right? I'm OG. I tend to say to these people, would you use Ameritrade or would you use Charles Schwab, right? Do you have an account? Have you ever traded stocks before? Because I don't believe that it's for everyone.
No, I totally agree.
And it's a lot easier when your next door neighbor goes, I bought this coin that's named after a German shepherd and the guy's going to be on Saturday Night Live next week and we're going to become millionaires.
Yeah.
This is a responsibility where I have to go, no, it's not. I don't know what to say. So you bring PIMCO in. You got the argument, decentralization versus centralization, damn the man attitude, and I'm all for it. I'm okay with that. As long as we have an equal amount of representation where maybe somebody who's not familiar can go to someone who has the experience, might be, we should say, legally allowed to give advice as opposed to a Twitter influencer, and introduce those people into cryptocurrency trading.
Yeah.
If PIMCO is going to go that route, then I am 100% behind it. Yeah. Maybe I just got soapbox for you a moment, but that's
right. Good. No, well, it brings a degree of professionalism. And in the same way, also this week, we've seen ProShares, again, a US business, it's the first ETF being traded. And they actually attracted an incredible, just under $900 million worth of new assets in the first couple of days of trading. So it shows the pent-up interest from certainly institutions and perhaps, you know, retail investors that are a little bit closer to the action, so to speak, that people and I'm not for one moment advocating, say, you should go out and buy a Bitcoin ETF or any cryptocurrency, because you're absolutely right. Buying any investment, there is a degree of risk. With cryptocurrencies, there's huge volatility. And, you know, would you put all your money into a penny share on the big board, as they say, or would you go and buy mining stock in Canada because you suddenly think it might hit a rich seam of, you know, minerals? Most people wouldn't. So why would they go into the crypto market that they understand nothing about? So caution, definitely. And we're certainly not advocating on this show that people buy or sell. But what we do really think people need to do is try and take a little bit of time and understand some of the risks, some of the opportunities, and see how you can use the technology for your benefit or your company's benefit. And that's the really interesting thing. And I think that's what PIMCO are doing. I think they're looking at the technology and saying, okay, maybe then this technology, we could use it as a way to make our business less risky, more compliant, more secure, and cheaper, because we can automate a lot of the systems and process. And that's where, well, we wrote a little bit about that this week, James. We had an article looking at custody. And as you well know, if you're going to manage money for someone, you know, you're a mutual fund, even someone like BlackRock, you know, BlackRock is the biggest asset manager in the world. And they got $7 trillion under management. But BlackRock don't hold your money. They don't hold the stocks and shares and the bonds. They are held by a separate custody, someone completely independent, you know, a company like, you know, Bank of New York Mellon or Euroclear or JP Morgan or State Street or Citi, you know, the list goes on. And they actually hold the assets. They're the custodian to say, yep, in the BlackRock fund, they hold, you know, Shell and Esso and Estee Lauder and Tesla or whatever it may well be. But there is an argument with digital assets. Do you need to pay for that extra cost of a custodian? Do you need the extra assurance? Because if it's digital and you've got transparency, you can see where those assets are, and then you could introduce this thing of a multi-signature account. So instead of just being controlled by, let's say in this case, it's just controlled by, you know, Bank of New York Mellon, for example, and they look after about $24 trillion worth of assets. These are big guys. Or Euroclear in Belgium have got, you know, just under $20 trillion worth of assets they act as custody. Maybe you'll end up with custodians being not just one, but maybe two or three people that have the ability. And the money cannot be moved unless the majority of the multi-signature account holders actually say, yes, it's okay to move it from this place to that place. So that opens up some quite interesting possibilities to cut costs and, in a funny way, actually make it even more secure than the current, rather than, because at the moment we're just relying on these big custodians to hope that they're all okay.
Yeah, it sounds to me like that's where you do satisfy some of the people some of the time by giving back a little bit of control while still maintaining their own stability, safety.
Yeah, no, very, 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 very much so. The other thing that we were looking at in this week's edition, we were looking at, you know, the whole subject of sort of ESG and seeing how environmental, social, corporate governance, ESG, how it's becoming a bigger and bigger issue. And, you know, we've got COP20 coming up here in the UK, where in Glasgow in a few weeks' time, we've got all majority of the world leaders coming together and saying, look, we've got to do something about our climate and the impact that, you know, mankind is having on the environment. And investors are increasingly saying, yeah, how much are you going to make for me? But how are you going to make it? And if you're going to make it in a way that is basically going to completely destroy the environment, well, then potentially, who, you know, is it worth having that type of company? Because you're destroying the very place I live in. And, you know, we've seen the gas prices, not petroleum prices, but, you know, actual natural gas prices across the world go up substantially this year. And, you know, burning gas is a fossil fuel. It's not great for the environment. And people say, look, we've got to have more renewable energy, or we've got to have energy sources where perhaps we can isolate ourselves from the volatility of some of these commodities. And what we're seeing here is actually, you know, more and more pressure for people to look at how do we actually use, if you like, the technology behind blockchain to actually give us greater clarity, greater transparency. But the trouble is some of these blockchains, so Bitcoin, for example, you know, Bitcoin uses, you know, as much electricity a year to power all the tea kettles in the UK for the next 23 years. It uses a huge amount of electricity. So Bitcoin's come under a lot of pressure. Some of your listeners will remember listening to or seeing tweets from Elon Musk saying, you know, I'm a buyer of Bitcoin. No, I don't like Bitcoin because it uses too much energy. But if you look at where the energy comes from, it's interesting to see that the miners claim that, you know, potentially up to over 76% of their energy use is coming from renewable energies. But Bitcoin isn't the only blockchain in the world. There are many other blockchains. And we found a survey from the University College of London, UCL, here in the UK. And they actually looked at five or six different blockchains and saw that unlike Bitcoin with proof of work, other blockchains using proof of stake were much, much more efficient when it came to the use of energy and therefore its impact potentially on the economy. So again, it's not a zero sum game. We're seeing more and more of this attention now being sort of devoted to with ESG and blockchain technology. Do you know what the footprint is for if you're going to start using this sort of technology? And we're seeing more efficient blockchains coming through.
Yeah, in layman's terms, I remember a year, 2 years ago, three, the last bull run, which I guess was 2017.
Yep.
There was a lot of, and I'm not an engineer by any stretch of the imagination, but they were saying, okay, Bitcoin requires a price point of $8,000 in order to pay the electric bill.
Yep.
And I would say, okay, well, I mean, high level, I get it. And I never really touched upon the subject too much. So where I live in Georgia, we're all nuclear. We have nuclear power. From what I understand, it's clean and it's efficient. Yep. And I could tell you my utility bill, beautiful. I'll pay this bill every month, no problem. So is that something that they're looking at? Like not just how proof of work versus proof of stake, but where? Does where become a big player with, you know, a nuclear area as opposed to, like you said, natural gas, windmills, right?
Yeah, well, we've seen a huge amount of money be invested in places like Texas, because Texas has one of the lowest energy prices in certainly in the States. And the reason for that is that there's a huge amount of solar and wind power. And one of the advantages, and it's interesting, you wrote about this in Digital Bytes a couple of months ago. What we're seeing now are Bitcoin and cryptocurrency mining facilities, warehouses with lots and lots of, you know, motherboards that are doing sort of the calculations for the actual blockchain. And you can turn those facilities on and off depending on the price of electricity. So, you know, during the morning when everyone's getting up and, you know, boiling the kettle and running the bath, and at night when perhaps there's, you know, the microwave's pinging away and the cooker's going and the TV's on. And these are high end demand times for electricity suppliers, and therefore the cost of electricity at those peaks is quite expensive. But middle of the night, you know, when everyone's tucked up in bed, then, you know, there's, and maybe the wind's blown a hoolie, then there's the price of electricity is really, really cheap, and they can turn on the Bitcoining and the blockchain mining rigs, and they can start producing an income off of very, very cheap or almost free energy. And that has the advantage, is that the electricity plants are actually getting a better return on their money. So their capital is being repaid faster and quicker because they're able to use that surplus energy to actually produce another source of income, not selling it to someone in their homes and factories, but selling it to, or using it themselves for Bitcoin mining rigs and blockchain mining facilities. So they've got an additional source of income. And we've already seen El Salvador, who have adopted cryptocurrencies as a form of payment. And they're looking to actually use their geothermal energy. They've got a few volcanoes which have been used to actually create electricity. But, you know, the geothermal, it creates electricity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And some days they just don't need the power. But if they stick a blockchain mining rig next to the power station, they can use that surplus energy, you know, at a very, very effective, sometimes almost free price.
Yeah, and I think that that's going to satisfy a lot of the new Green Deal type people out there. That, and it should, right? We also don't want to. I don't want to be that guy that's out there saying, "Okay, I'm going to go buy a new car, and I'm going to pay with Bitcoin," you know, using my Coinbase debit card or whatever, maybe a used car, and say, "Well, I'm going to buy it after 8 p.m." because the transaction will be faster. That'll never work. But it's true. A real-life scenario.
Yeah, yeah. But it's also, you know, increasingly, you know, we're talking to companies about, okay, so we know we've got to get involved in this. We know we've got to do something on the blockchain. Which blockchain do I use? Because, you know, I am mindful of my ESG credentials and my sort of corporate footprint as a business. And if you have a public blockchain, yes, it's more secure, but it does use up more power. And I think increasingly we're going to see people that are employing this technology. It will be one of the questions they're going to ask. You know, can you, you know, I'm looking at three different blockchains, and if they all basically do the same thing, but one of those blockchains is more energy efficient, i.e. uses less energy. I don't think it's going to be a matter of cost, but I think it's going to be a matter of, we want to tell our shareholders and our staff and our customers that right the way through our business, you know, having sort of environmental and social and corporate governance at the core of our business is really, really important. So this is why I think there's going to be increasing focus on in all technologies, but particularly with blockchain technology, because it's had such a bad press about the amount of power it potentially uses. People are beginning to question and say, okay, well, is there a more efficient way to actually move money around on different blockchains and use, if you like, new iterations? So on Bitcoin, for example, they're talking about using Lightning networks, whereby they use a fraction of the power to achieve almost the same sort of result in terms of being able to use a blockchain. So it's evolving and changing, which is obviously a good thing. And that's part of fun, James. That's why, you know, we have this show, because, you know, the whole market is changing so quickly and we're all learning. I still don't really believe there's any experts in this area. You know, I've been doing it for 5 years and we spend about 20, 25 hours a week just doing the research and writing Digital Bytes. And the more we do, the more we realize how little we do know. So that's what makes it interesting.
That's the great thing, is that you go, just when I got this figured out, I'm a pro. I got this down pat. Oh, look at this article about proof of stake versus proof of work and kilowatts per hour. I'm out. All over again.
Yeah. Okay. Well, James, so coming up after the break, we've got a chap called Ben Davis, and he's going to be talking to us about decentralized insurance and centralized insurance and explaining some of the examples how we're seeing more and more companies that are engaged in digital assets. It might be digital bond, digital equities, it might be a crypto exchange, might be someone doing crypto custody, and how increasingly the insurance market is prepared to take that risk on. And I found really interestingly what he was talking about was the fact that Sometimes someone comes to them with a requirement for, say, director's insurance or for sort of loss of assets or liability insurance, and they're splitting out the insurance and they're saying, well, some of that insurance can be met in the DeFi world and some of it can be met in the traditional sort of centralized insurance world. So we're really seeing a blend of the two ecosystems, DeFi and centralized finance, coming together to actually solve real business issues, and insurance is being underwritten and sold, you know, here in London, but also I know very active in New York and increasingly sort of in Singapore, which are the three main sort of insurance centers with various underwriting capabilities, very much being supported by Bermuda just off. Probably on a clear day, you might just be able to see Bermuda from your house.
Yeah, right. If I get up high enough from sea level.
With a very good telescope.
Very good telescope. And, you know, we are actually building down here a 1,000-foot observatory deck. It's going to be very similar to, like, the Freedom Tower up in Manhattan in Florida. And I read about that, and I was like, wow, that's kind of defies the lack of bedrock, right? We have that silted soil down here. But that goes again with technology. You know, maybe on the bottom floor will be a gigantic generator for electric for mining. Who knows? You could hide stuff in there nowadays. But, yeah, I'd be able to see things from afar. And I think insurance, a lot of us don't have that experience. I'm going to be very quiet, more like taking notes when it comes to insurance. But that's, can you see the forest? What do they say? Can you see the trees from the forest?
See the woods from the trees.
Right, right. So, you know, you always have to have insurance. Typically, in the United States, you don't trust insurance people. They're about as shady as car salesmen. So, absolutely, I think blockchain can automate and increase trust, permission, and still fulfill those requirements where if you're going to function in this world, you have to have insurance, regardless.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, well, totally. And yeah, you know, a lot of, you know, senior directors that these businesses need to lend their credibility and experience and knowledge, they're not going to come on the boards of these companies unless they've got insurance. And a lot of the investors won't invest unless, you know, let's be honest, if you can't get insurance, it makes the business venture much, it just puts a question mark. If you can't get insurance, why can't you? There's no real excuse now because, you know, insurance in the insurance market has been doing cyber insurance for many years. And a lot of the risks on cyber are not dissimilar to in the crypto sort of sphere. But as, again, going back to PIMCO, as we start seeing people like PIMCO coming involved, they're going to have to go to their underwriter and say, we're now getting involved in this area. They have to have insurance for their PI, professional indemnity, because they're a regulated entity. So the more people get involved, it's the economies of scale, and we're going to see premiums falling and more underwriters get involved. So very much a virtuous circle. So, yeah, interesting to see how that market's evolving and developing.
I'd be willing to say that that's much more bleeding edge. Right. Definitely newer, which is why, like I said, more of a learning experience. Everybody's an expert, I think you said earlier. And then just when you become an expert, oh, wait, we got to learn about insurance. That's right. Brilliant. So definitely a very primarily important sector that we probably overlooked as regular people.
Yeah. Okay, so James, so anyone that obviously wants to get a copy of Digital Bytes, they're very welcome. They can either contact you at CyberFM or find you on LinkedIn, or you know, or myself, Johnny Fry, Jonny. I'm on LinkedIn, and I know you are as well, James. They can just contact you or me, and then we'll make sure they get a copy of Digital Bytes. So it's James Tiley. Mind you, your readers know you well enough. And we'll happily send you a copy, and you can have you'll see in Digital Bytes, there's a lot of sort of blue writing, and the blue writing are hyperlinks. So we then, when we talk about statistics and figures, we then can give you a hyperlink to support those numbers and quotes, and explain a little bit more about maybe a business or maybe where the statistics have come from. So everything is totally verified. so you know we're not just making it up, and it gives you a little bit more reading and research if so required. But James, we'll be back after the break, and yeah, good being back on the air with you.
Yeah, and we will make it easier as we integrate Cyber FM. You'll be able to sign up and get this newsletter and a lot easier access. But agreed, no fake news, and definitely cutting edge new stuff. If you keep me quiet, then you know we're definitely on the brink of something new.
We'll do our best. Okay, well, we'll talk after the break again, James.
Alrighty. Coming up, what was his name again?
Ben Davis.
Ben Davis, after this moment.
Cyber.fm.
Oh, it's another week over here at Cyber FM Radio with Team Blockchain handing out the Digital Bytes newsletter to apparently some new people, as well as the existing fans of Johnny Fry and his craft with Digital Bytes. And this week, I'm going to bring Johnny on. He's talking to Ben Davis, who wrote a guest article about, apparently, crypto asset insurance, and it compares DeFi versus what I call CeFi. But Johnny and Ben will take over and clarify everything. How are you guys doing today?
Yeah, all good. All good. Thanks very much indeed, James, and great to be back on the air. And really pleased to be joined this week by Ben Davis, who's head of an insurance broker business called Superscript, and he looks after their international business and emerging technology, which obviously includes crypto and the like. So Ben, welcome on the Digital Bytes show.
Thanks, Johnny. Yeah, really great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now Ben, I know I sent it to you, but we had a couple of people actually write to us, and I've had a couple of phone calls from some of our readers that get Digital Bytes, and they really liked your article in Digital Bytes this week about crypto asset insurance. And I suppose to sort of price it, sort of the whole sort of decentralized finance, DeFi, and the traditional centralized finance. And just interested if you can sort of walk us through, you know, how you see the insurance sort of fitting in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, when we look at the kind of the opportunity for digital assets and things like that, we think about DeFi, we think about lending and, you know, on-chain finance. But what we don't actually think about a lot is either protecting those companies or really about kind of insurance and how we risk, you know, manage our risk in that way. And so I think it's, you know, this kind of untouched area of opportunity, which is essentially, you know, insuring the companies that are trying to change our future, right? You know, if you look at where our society, you know, hopefully will be in 5 years in terms of, you know, digital assets and the real use cases that are being demonstrated, you know, these companies need support. They need insurance. They need somebody to protect them if things don't always kind of work out to plan. And, you know, when you're a startup, you know, insurance probably isn't the first thing on your mind. But, you know, as soon as you start getting contracts and you start building your business, at some point down that line, you're going to need to have some financial backing by an insurer, because, you know, without that, you might not be able to win that contract, or you might not be able to get that director on your board without having the right cover. So we have, you know, quite a big book of business in, you know, for crypto asset clients that are looking at insurance for their businesses. And this, the, you know, the insurance isn't always just for the theft of digital assets, right? It's cyber insurance. It's errors and omissions cover. It's directors and officers insurance. It's actually, you know, protecting the functioning of that business, not necessarily just like the theft or, you know, volatility or fluctuation of that asset. And really, I think what we'll eventually get to in insurance is where you'll have a, you know, an insurance broker like myself interact with both DeFi and CeFi insurance carriers. They'll just have different appetites. So, for example, right now, I know for smart contract cover, the best way that I can cover my clients is for them to actually go on and go through a DeFi staking protocol, because they'll be able to get much broader cover at a much cheaper price than going through the traditional insurance market. However, I know if they want directors and officers or errors and omissions cover, it's much better to go through the centralized insurance market, because there is appetite. There are, you know, we are finding solutions for our clients in the centralized financial insurance industry. And what the really nice thing is every policy that we do bind with this, you know, CFI industry is just another step towards having more and more insurers get comfortable with the risk, have more capacity to take on these risks. And, you know, everybody wins because of that, because prices come down, wording gets better, and the risk becomes something that the insurers are comfortable with. So I think, you know, we've got a massive, massive opportunity that's coming down the pipe, and there'll be a lot of winners out of it, both in the DeFi and the CeFi landscape.
Okay, so Ben, so can we go sort of back to sort of real basics? Am I correct in saying you've got businesses that are involved in digital assets, in crypto assets? They may be trading them, there may be exchanges, or there may be custody or storage, and in you're able to get insurance for them on their business, which then gives comfort to shareholders and directors of those. You're writing business, right? Not hoping to, you're actually writing business.
Oh, no, no. Yeah. It's our biggest book by premium by far for our company right now.
And the underwriters, who are the underwriters? Are they?
Well, yeah, the underwriters vary depending. Yeah, it varies on the risk. So we'll go to underwriters in London and in Bermuda. I'm originally from Canada, but I've moved over to London, the UK 6 years ago, and have been in the digital asset insurance space for 4 years now. And yeah, we're finding insurance for custodians, exchanges, NFT verification platforms, tokenization platforms. Wow. You know, pretty much everything under the sun, pretty much we've had a look at and have, you know, gone through the business in great detail. So yeah, it's this is not one of those things where we're interested, we're looking at this in 3 years. No, this is something that, you know, probably takes up 80% of my time at the moment.
Okay. And you're also, from what I understand, you're saying some of the ways that a company can get insurance or protect itself or its directors or its shareholders, some of that is going to be in the traditional centralized finance world of, you know, yep, wandering around Lloyd's with your clipboard and getting the policy underwritten. And some you're going straight into DeFi and you're actually able to get insurance, you know, in the sort of virtual land, but actually get it underwritten that way as well. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly right, Johnny. So it all depends on the risk and the risk appetite of the company. But, you know, it also depends on why they need the insurance. So if they need the insurance for a contract or for, you know, for a lot of these growing companies that might be at the, you know, 30, 40 million dollar valuation metric, and they want to get to that 100 million valuation metric, and they need to get a certain high profile director on their board to get to that metric, that high profile director won't join unless they have directors and officers insurance. So it's all about making sure that we can keep our clients' companies growing by protecting their assets if something went wrong. So so for something like that, that's a much better risk placed in the centralized financial industry, because the director wants to see financial rated paper.
Yep.
However, if it's something like, you know, we've got a client that deploys capital into decentralized exchanges and different DeFi protocols, and they want to make sure that when they do that, that if there was a hack on the contract and there was their money was stolen, that they have some protection. And so it makes complete sense for them to go into something like Nexus Mutual, which is a decentralized insurance provider. They stake their own tokens on those contracts that they've deployed their capacity into. And if there's a hack, they get those tokens, they get paid out. And if there isn't, they get their tokens back with interest. So it makes complete business sense to interact in the decentralized world for that type of risk.
And you mentioned Nexus Mutual, and is the only thing they do is DeFi, or do they have any exposure in the traditional world as well?
I think right now they are, I believe, just a DeFi insurance provider. However, they are a constantly expanding and growing team, and they've got some big ambitions. So I think you know, it's just a matter of time before we start seeing them offer, you know, more traditional insurance policies alongside their smart contract cover.
Okay, and going back to the sort of crusty old world of Lloyd's and sort of having a cup of tea and agreeing to take on a risk, and that's kind of how it, you know, originally started around the coffee houses in the City of London. You're seeing obviously the traditional insurers have had a challenge with cyber insurance.
Yes.
So a lot of the risks, I suppose, or some of the risks that share some similarities with cryptographic sort of and cryptocurrency type risk, because it's very much IT driven. And it's very intangible until it's kind of almost too late and the money's disappeared. So presumably they have a degree of understanding of some of the risks that they are prepared to take on board. And some presumably they say, no, that's not for us.
Yeah, Johnny, I mean, that's a brilliant point. And actually, that's something that we have done quite extensively. I think when an underwriter sees a risk that has cryptocurrency in the title, or you know, they get scared. They think, oh, I don't really understand this. I don't want to underwrite it. But what we're kind of saying, and how we've had success before, is we're actually using proxy. So we're saying, actually, you know, this risk isn't so different to the risk you just wrote, you know, 2 weeks ago for us. If you look at it from a pure cyber standpoint, because it has crypto, there isn't any actual change in the risk exposure. I mean, the biggest risk for cyber right now is ransomware and business interruption. There is no data to suggest that you owning cryptocurrency makes you a higher target for ransomware or makes you a worse business from a business interruption perspective. If anything, it probably increases the you probably have better risk management because you've had to have you know, you probably have done some penetration testing, you've probably had your smart contract audited, you've probably, you know, had to do multiple security tests to make sure that your business can function you know, in a disaster. So actually, you know, if we're talking to an underwriter, it's probably a better risk than a lot of the risks they already have on their books. And so it's just this complete, you know, disconnect between the actual fundamentals of the risk and what the risk actually is. And so that's the war we're kind of waging right now, is we're trying to get in front of these underwriters, and we are, and you know, we're slowly changing some minds. But you know, unfortunately, these companies are big. They move very slowly. They're naturally risk adverse. And so, you know, how we kind of get the deal done really is to start from an education point of view. So we'll do a presentation for them. We'll go through a few of our files. We'll go through how we've underwritten it. We'll go through how other insurance companies have underwritten. We'll show them how it's similar to another risk. We'll talk about pricing. We'll kind of hold their hand through it. And you know, because of that, they trust us to show them the right business. And you know, it's more of a partnership rather than just like, you know, flinging over a submission and saying, oh, just write this risk. It's more of a, let me come alongside you. Let's talk through the actual risk and see if we can get, you know, to some sort of agreement.
Right. And for the listeners who aren't sort of familiar with it, for regulated companies, they have no choice. They have to have insurance in their business, as you say, Ben, just in case something happens that they haven't thought about and it slipped through from a compliance and procedure. So this isn't a sort of it's nice to have. It's something the regulators are going to insist on. And it was, you know, historically a real stumbling block. And in the past, you know, I know when we first started talking about, you know, sort of 3 or 4 years ago, there was the challenge of, you know, can you get a bank account? What's happening about custody? Do we have a proper exchange? And the fourth one of those was insurance. And it's great to see that the insurance market is maturing and it's prepared to take on some of the potential risks. And you know, over time, presumably, as people get more comfortable with this and they see the claims history, then the pricing is going to get more and more competitive.
Absolutely. And do you know what? It's actually fascinating to see. So we're in right now what's called the hard market in insurance, which means there's not enough insurers putting out quotes. The quotes they do put out are more expensive, and the wording, so the actual coverage, is tighter, so that they're not as covering as much. So this is a hard market that we're in. But even despite that, we've actually had a few traditional insurance companies that you'd never think would be interested in digital assets or blockchain or anything like that. They've actually reached out to us and said, oh, well, you know, we kind of see this space. We've been on the sidelines for the last few years, and we're thinking about kind of entering into it. What are you guys doing? Would love to have a chat. You know, maybe we could partner on something. So It's the winds are slowly changing. And it's actually, as brokers, we're actually not having as many insurers decline the risks as we would have had, 1 or 2 years ago. So, maybe 1 or 2 years ago, the hit rate for actually getting a company a quote would maybe be 30%. It's something like for us, it's something like, from the start of the process to actual quoting stage, I think we quote about probably, 70% of the businesses we see. So it's actually quite a high rate of.
And how long does it take to get that sort of cut? Is it a couple of weeks, or realistically, is it going to take, 6, 7 weeks for people to understand the business and the risk
Yeah,
attached to it?
it depends on the complexity of the risk, and depends on where they're domiciled. It depends on
Got
the
it.
experience of the directors and things like that. But really, because they're being so inundated with submissions, it's really something going to be about a month to 2 months, because you have to think of the degree of due diligence that we have to do in the digital asset space. We really have to get to know these companies, because I need to know, pretty much everything these companies are doing, so that when I talk to the underwriter, we can make the best representation of the entire risk in the entire company. So, it's a lot. We jump on a call, we request a lot of information, we do our own submission forms, we do reviews. We'll maybe even organize an underwriting call, depending on how big it is and how complex it is. So it is a thorough process, but it's very rewarding, because a lot of the time, we'll kind of consult with our clients and say, well, before we even get to this stage, I need you to go away and fix these few points you put down, because I know the underwriters aren't going to like it. And if we want to get the best price and the best terms, let's just fix these before we even submit it. So it's kind of, that pre-underwriting role that we fill to kind of help our businesses get insurance at the best price, really.
Okay, and your clients, without giving any names away, they're presumably not just UK based. I know you're based in the UK,
No.
and that these are global clients that have come to London because it's historically well known as an underwriting centre. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've got clients, publicly traded clients in Canada, Sweden, Estonia, Australia, US,
Wow.
Canada, all over the place. It's really, we're kind of a global hub for this type of specialized business. And it's basically, it runs the gamut all over the world. So it's very exciting. Sometimes, I'm on a call with Estonia at one time, and then have to wait a little bit after work to talk to Canada or East Coast US. So it's never a dull moment.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, Ben, really interesting, and really like the article. As I say, in this week's Digital Bites, that as I say, it was crypto asset insurance, DeFi versus CeFi. James, you've been very quiet. Any thoughts? Any questions on anything before we wrap up the show this week with Ben?
Well, actually, it's funny. This was one of the learning experiences for me, so that's why I was so quiet. I was like, oh. And I had dealt with cyber insurance once, and it was in a ransomware situation for a firm in Jacksonville, Florida. But outside of that, I had no experience. So it sounds like this is all brand new, and they're really kind of changing that game. This was me more paying attention this time.
Okay. Well, look, Ben, thank you very much for your article, and we'll try and twist your arm and get you to give us an update and some examples of things, perhaps. Early in 2022, but really appreciate you coming on the show today, and James, good to be speaking to you for the rest of the show, and I think that's, as they say in your world, it's a wrap. So we'll be back on the air next week with another edition of Digital Bites, and if anyone wants a hard copy, an email of Digital Bites, then obviously you can either get hold of James at Cyber FM or myself, Johnny JONN. Why Johnny Fry on LinkedIn, and we'll happily put you on the list to receive Digital Bites. It comes out every Wednesday in the morning, London time. And good to be talking to you again, James. Thank you.
Thank you
Yeah,
both.
as always, I will see you on the other side. And thanks a lot again.